Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we will return to a topic we have discussed before, and I'm certain it's one we'll continue to discuss as we move into the years ahead, and that is Medicare and its future, its present and future condition. Medicare is a program that now provides health care coverage for something like 42 million Americans, most of them seniors. And that figure is expected to rise significantly in the near future as the members of the baby boom generation retires. At the same time, the number of workers that pay into the system to support it is expected to drop. And the concern is that if nothing changes, this is a system that is headed for collapse. Some of the same concerns have been raised about Social Security. Well, this morning we will again approach this topic, talking a little bit about the future of Medicare with David Hyman. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. He is, in fact, professor of law and medicine, and his particular interest is in health law and health care regulation. He is the author of a recently published book that is titled Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. It is published by the Cato Institute, and it looks at the program in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way, although it is in many ways a straightforward kind of piece of policy analysis. And we will talk about it basically in that way and give people the opportunity to call in here, ask questions, make comments. I'm sure this is not the last show that we will do on this subject. We will do others. We have in the past trying to talk with different people who have different viewpoints on this. But as we were just chatting here, I think that one thing everybody agrees on is that we can't keep going on the way we are. The point of disagreement comes when people say, all right, what are we going to do? Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David, for having me.
And as I tried to explain, and maybe we could talk a little bit more here just at the beginning, your way of approaching the subject is, in a sense, to give people a slightly different sort of off-kilter way of looking at it, perhaps, is looking at this question, or perhaps posing this question, if some sort of evil force was interested in damaging the United States, they could do little better than to come up with Medicare. So defend that defend that kind of position a little bit here to start out with.
Well, first of all, I want to make clear that the book is a satirical look at the Medicare program. The sort of structure of the book is it's framed as a letter or a memo from a junior underling demon in the Department of Illness and Satanic Services, or DISS, to the devil, reporting on how their plans are going to undermine the American Republic with a program that corrupts everyone it touches and undermines the distinctively American virtues of thrift and truth-telling. And the framework of the book is it sort of systematically looks at the seven deadly sins and outlines how, essentially, albeit satirically, Medicare maps fairly neatly onto each of those sins, specifically avarice, gluttony, envy, sloth, lust, anger, and vanity. And it identifies individual groups that are affected by each of those sins and shows how the sort of real-world consequences of the Medicare program has been to actually make all of those things worse rather than better. And I want to emphasize, I think it's quite clear Medicare was enacted with the best of intentions. The people who did it thought that this was a wonderful solution to a very troubling problem. But the specific framework that they chose and the consequences that we now see 40-some years later, I think ought to lead us to question the framework that they used and to think creatively about ways of changing the trajectory of the program, because it's there are some real problems with the program. First of all, it's financially unsustainable in its current form. You don't have to take my word for it. The book includes quotes from people across the political spectrum under both administrations, both Democratic and Republican administrations, saying that we have to make fundamental changes in this program in order for us to be able to continue to afford it. The other problem that doesn't catch as much attention, though, is the quality of services that are delivered under the Medicare program are actually not all that hot. Thoroughly mediocre would be a nice way to put it. We pay a lot for some services that we don't need to. We underpay for other services, and that has predictable consequences on the availability of those services. We also end up, not delivering things that people need and delivering things that people don't need. So a very concrete example, if you live in Florida, you're much more likely to get lots and lots of things done to you. They won't make your health better. In certain respects, they'll make your health worse, but they cost the program a lot of money. So the sort of standard estimate here is if every person, Medicare beneficiary in Florida, agreed to get Minnesota-style health care, that is the kind of care you got if you lived in Minnesota, they'd all be equally healthy or better off. And the program could buy each and every one of those beneficiaries a top-of-the-line, fully loaded Lexus, and the program would still come out ahead financially. That's the difference in the type of care you receive depending upon where you live.
Well, there obviously there are a whole number of questions here we could ask. But again, sort of taking off from the conceit of the book, it sounds as if what you're arguing is that one of the big problems with the system is that there's no one who felt that it was in their interest to control how much was spent. That is, people getting benefits, they felt they should have the benefit, and they didn't actually feel that they were paying. It wasn't coming out of their pocket. People who were providing the benefits were getting paid to provide the benefits, and apparently there was really no one anywhere along the line, at least until recently, who felt that they should say, should we be controlling costs here? No one seemed to be having their eye on the bottom line.
Well, I think certainly the beneficiaries and the providers both view this as found money or found medical services on one side and reimbursement on the other side. And so neither of them had much in the way of incentive to say, are we getting our money's worth and how much is enough? And the taxpayers, obviously, because the costs of the program are very diffuse, you know, each worker pays for the hospitalization benefit out of their wages, and then there's some general tax revenues. All that means that individual taxpayers don't really see the cost of this program. And program administrators and legislators, I think, have been deeply worried about the program starting from relatively quickly after its enactment. The projections for the total cost of the program, if you lay them against the expenditures, there's huge divergence almost from the first year. There was massive inflationary pressure as a result of the enactment of the program. So people have been worried about it in the government side of the equation, but they haven't really been able to do a whole lot in order to fix the trajectory of the program. They've done a number of things. They changed the way in which we reimburse hospitals. They've changed the way in which we reimburse physicians. They've tried to enact some controls over the volume of the services that are paid. But the difficulty is, you know, the beneficiaries are all voters. And so it's, you know, it's very hard to create a political dynamic where you're taking things away from people who've gotten used to getting them and explaining to them that it's not good for them, but it's good for other people, and so they should be happy. That's not going to be much of a easy sale. And the sort of larger dynamic here, you know, people focus on Social Security. The problems with Medicare are actually much worse than with Social Security. They hit sooner and they're much bigger. And the reasons for that are partly the demographic reason that you outlined earlier, increasing number of elderly and decreasing number of workers. But the other problem, which makes Medicare much worse, is the cost increases in Medicare are driven off the cost of medical services, both their volume and their cost per unit, whereas Social Security is just tied to the general rate of inflation. And since medical inflation is about 3 to 4 times the rate of general inflation, you can see how compounding that over time makes things much worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you ask the question, as the question has been asked of Social Security, when does the crunch come? Do you have an answer for that question? And it sounds like it would be sooner than the projected crunch for Social Security.
It's much sooner than the projected crunch. Now, the answer is a little complex because Medicare is made up of different pieces. The hospitalization benefit, or what's called Part A, has the same trust fund structure that Social Security has, so you can compare that quite directly. But there are other parts. There's Part B, which provides for physician services. And that doesn't have a trust fund because of the way in which it's financed. So you can't sort of say the money's, you know, run out or we'll have to come up with general tax revenues at a certain point in time because we're coming up with general tax revenues currently for that program. And Part D, the pharmaceutical benefit that just got enacted, is somewhat similar. Both Part B and Part D are financed partly by contributions from the beneficiaries, but mostly by general tax revenues. So let's just focus on Part A for a minute, and then we can talk about the larger program. And there is a way to talk about the costs of the larger program that I think makes the numbers meaningful. So Part A, the trust fund, there are really two measures that you're going to be interested in. One is when the money coming into the system is less than the money that's going out of the system on a year-to-year basis. And then second, because it's a, quote, trust fund, that is, it holds pieces of paper that represent calls on future treasury payments, when all of those are gone. Most people use the second number typically as the when the trust fund is bankrupt, although I don't much like that terminology. And there's actually a figure in the book. It's figure 10-1 on page 77 that shows the estimated years to Medicare Part A trust fund. And what it shows is that the most recent figures are, I think, around 14 years to trust fund exhaustion. But if you also look at that figure, it shows it's never been more than 30 years. So we've all been paying into a program with a promise of future indefinite benefits, but it's never had more than 30 years to exhaustion. Now, you wouldn't buy a private annuity that promised you pay in now and we'll pay you forever, but oh, by the way, there won't be any money after 30 years, let alone 15, let alone sometimes 7. So you can see the program's never been on a really sustainable financial basis. Mm. The other way of just sort of collecting everything together, all of the parts of the program, is to ask yourself the question, how much have we promised to pay versus how much do we project coming in? And you can do this over short-term, long-term, medium-term, infinite term if you want to. The longer term the projections, the less reliable they come, but they give you a sense of how much are we in hock for. That's the sort of short form. And if you use the sort of most expansive measure, you discover that we've promised to pay about $71 trillion that we don't have.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, David Hyman. He's professor of law and medicine at the University of Illinois. He is interested in the regulation of healthcare financing and delivery. He is the author of the book Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. It's published by the Cato Institute, and it is a look at the problem that we have been talking about, that is the structure and future of Medicare. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to the point that you made about the fact that if you look at the kind of care that people receive and what it costs, and you compare states, for example, your comparison was the state of Florida and the state of Minnesota, mm-hmm. That there is a great deal of difference in how much care and how much money is spent on the care for people in the two places. So that invites a natural question, well, why is it? Why is that the case? Why is there not more standardization among the states in the terms of what it is that people get?
That's a great question, David. There are a couple of different things you need to look at. One is the difference in cost, and there are differences in the cost of production of medical services in different states. Okay, it's more expensive to live in New York than it is to live in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, some of that ends up running through the cost of medical care as well. Independent of that, there are differences in the treatment patterns. Where you live has a profound effect on the kind of medical treatment you receive. And there have been some very nice research on this done over a series of 20 or so years by a bunch of people at Dartmouth Medical School. And what they've determined is that variation in treatment patterns is partly influenced by the supply of services. So if there are more of certain kinds of services, they'll get used more. There's also variation in what are called preference-sensitive services. So doctors' preferences, how they choose to practice, will end up affecting the patterns of medical treatment as well. So if you're in one part of the country and you've got a certain set of symptoms, you'll get one treatment, and in another part of the country, you'll get a very different treatment. And these can be physically adjoining areas. They're just local cultural ways in which the physicians end up practicing. And in combination, variations in treatment patterns and variations in cost end up profoundly affecting the quality of the medical care that people receive and the cost of that care as well. So there's a figure in the book that says payments per beneficiary are about $3,000 a person in Iowa and about $10,000 in the District of Columbia. So really a threefold variation in cost. Hmm. And if you look at individual treatments, you can see six and even tenfold variation in treatment patterns. So in terms of Medicare per 1,000 Medicare beneficiaries, the likelihood of receiving a bypass or having an angioplasty or a hysterectomy, you can sort of go through a wide range of medical treatments and see huge variation.
Well, let me ask you one more question, and then we have several callers I want to get to. I guess it's my understanding that there is the matter of reimbursement, that is, how much Medicare will pay for a particular procedure is set. So that it means that Medicare has decided if you're going to give your patient an MRI, this is how much we're going to pay. And if you decide that it costs more than that, well, somebody, it's going to have to come out of somebody's pocket. So either the patient is going to have to pay it, or maybe they have Medigap insurance that's going to pay the difference or something like that. And I guess my understanding would be that Medicare would reimburse the same for an MRI in Florida as in Minnesota. Is that right?
That's mostly right. It will pay. There are, as I said a few minutes ago, some variation in what they'll pay based on what they think it costs to do something. Okay. The Medicare reimbursement system is actually complex. You'll have to have me back and talk for a whole hour about the way that that works. But generally, they pay within, you know, some reasonably narrow margins the same for specific services, and there's some geographic variation again. But the larger point, though, is that Medicare is a fee-for-service model of healthcare where providers decide what their patients need, they provide it, and then they send in a bill, and Medicare basically pays it. Mm.
Okay. So then the difference would be not in what Medicare pays for the procedures, but whether the procedures are ordered at all. And it sounds like what you're saying, again, to go back to our Florida-Minnesota comparison, that the doctors in Florida would be more likely to decide this patient needs an MRI than the doctors in Minnesota?
Most of the difference in geographic variation in terms of the cost that varies geographically is driven off of variations in treatment patterns, not off of variations in the price. Now, there are some variations in the price or the amount that mm-hmm. Medicare reimburses more properly, but most of it is treatment variation patterns.
We have several callers here. Let's get right to them. Someone on a cell phone, someone calling from Bloomington. So we'll start there. Line one. Hello.
Yep. Yes, good morning. Just a couple of quick questions, and I'll hang up and you can answer. One is I'm really amazed at the inflation rate of healthcare, and maybe somebody can address that to me. Why is healthcare up 4% or, you know, four times what the inflation rate is? That's one question. And the other question is I think we need the American people and need some serious help in how we're going to get our politicians to make the changes that need to be changed, that need to be done. Thank you.
All right. Well, can you talk about that?
Yeah, those are the first is certainly an important question in terms of the gap between people's perceptions and what's actually going on. The most important factor in inflation rate in healthcare, I think it's quite clear, is technology. Okay, the more things we can do for more people, the more it costs, and the consequently, the more we spend this year than last year, and then the year before, and so on and so on. Now, there's some other confounding things going on, right? The aging of the population means that there are more people who need more things. The prevalence of third-party reimbursement arrangements, where somebody else is footing the bill, removes the typical natural restraint on willingness to spend on healthcare services. General inflation is obviously part of that as well, and I think those are made the main factors. With technology, I think it's quite clear being the number one driver of the inflation rate in spending on healthcare services. Mm-hmm. In terms of help in getting politicians to see, what we should do, I think there are a couple of difficulties. One, I think, plausible response is politicians are giving us exactly what they think we want, which is no limits on reimbursement, or I should say no limits on third-party payment for Medicare until the bill finally comes due. And I think, you know, part of the difficulty is in theory everybody understands that we can't keep this going indefinitely, but in practice people are reluctant to be the ones left holding the bag. So I certainly agree that we can't continue on the current trajectory. Figuring out how to encourage people to face up to that is part of why I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that if we cut to the chase here and ask the question about what you're going to do, what one might do, there seem to be two basic ways of trying to get at it. One is a way that says that if the problem is third-party paying and the fact that individual healthcare consumers don't feel the cost, then you have to set it up somehow so that they do, so that they understand what the cost of the service is and that we give them some incentive to make the decision for themselves to say, do I need this procedure or not, and make them feel the cost of it somehow. I suppose the other side of that is to say, no, really the problem with healthcare cost has to do with administering the system. And if we get those costs taken care of, some people argue that we wouldn't have the problem that we do. Now, embedded in that, something that I think people also don't like to think about is the fact that there's going to have to be somebody else deciding what you're going to get and what you don't. Is that basically the way when you ask the question, okay, what do we do? Is that basically the way that it seems to break down between those two sort of big groups of people who make one or the other argument?
I think you're being fair to the first group and you're being a little unfair to the second group, at least until the very end. So let me explain what I mean by that. There's certainly a group of people whose view is that in order to get people to restrain healthcare expenditures, the natural person to make those decisions is the person whose health is affected. And so what you should do is figure out ways of making people face the, you know, cost, quality, access trade-offs themselves rather than trying to come up with other people to do it for them. And so the sort of interest in health savings accounts and defined contribution approaches to Medicare, I think, are consistent with that general model where given the choice between centralized rationing and individual cost-benefit trade-offs, a whole bunch of people think the individualized approach is the way to go. On the second group, I don't really know anybody who thinks we can solve this problem in the long run by lowering the administrative costs. Okay, and so I think, you know, I'm all in favor of lowering administrative costs where we can lower them effectively, that is, without, you know, losing whatever benefits we think we're getting from administrative costs. And, you know, there are costs and benefits to administrative costs just like everything else. But I think the other approach is to say, look, we need centralized purchasing with a strong decision-making in terms of making cost-quality trade-offs. So if that means empowering a centralized bureaucrat to make decisions about who should get what, then that's the cost of universal access. Okay, the basic choice is sort of, you know, leveling up or leveling down. And we don't particularly seem to want to do either of them. We're not willing to pay to level up, and we're not willing to suffer the consequences of leveling down.
So just real quick, and again, we'll get right back to the phones here. For those people who make the argument, those people who are arguing in favor of a single-payer national health system of the Canadian model, the one that people seem to like to point to, for those people who make the argument that we're going to, by going to this single-payer, by eliminating a lot of healthcare administration, by taking the costs out of the system as we run it now, we're going to save a whole bunch of money and that's going to lower the overall cost of care, you don't accept that argument.
I guess I'd make two points. I think we could save administrative costs by, you know, centralizing purchasing. How low we should make them is a different question. There's actually good evidence Medicare's administrative costs are too low, because the program actually has really poor fiscal controls. There's a section on fraud in the book that talks about these difficulties. So you want to be careful about driving your administrative costs too low. I think you can actually drive administrative costs down through a variety of mechanisms. And as I said, we ought to be in favor of that if it makes sense to do it. But the notion that by doing that you're going to change the, you know, technological drivers of healthcare inflation is just foolish. Okay, that's going to over. Even if you have, you know, 20% 1 year savings in administrative costs, which is, you know, substantial, you're going to make that up in about 5 or 6 years of healthcare cost inflation at the rate that we run it. So, you know, you're going to face these situations and these trade-offs sooner or later. And then you're back in the original question: who should make these trade-offs? Should individuals make them for themselves? Should they delegate someone else to make them for them? Or should we have a centralized approach to doing it in Washington or in Springfield?
Our guest, David Hyman, he's a professor of law and of medicine here at the University of Illinois. He's interested in the regulation of healthcare financing and delivery. He served for 3 years as special counsel of the Federal Trade Commission, where he was responsible for coordinating hearings and a major report on healthcare and competition law and policy. He's the author of the book Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. It's published by the Cato Institute. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go to the next caller, and that's Champagne on line two. Hello.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, you sort of alluded to already. Medicare actually has the lowest administrative cost of any insurance plan in the country. And while, you know, perhaps having it so low is a bit of a problem, as you point out, about, you know, checking fraud, maybe being able to save some money that way. I would say, you kind of alluded to this too, but, you know, a big chunk of money could be saved too if Medicare would negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies, which they're by law not allowed to do right now. I think that I'm skeptical about your point that a single payer plan or some sort of national health care plan on that sort of model wouldn't save money overall, because when you look at other nations around the world that have national health care plans that actually have better health outcomes, when you compare statistics in terms of the overall health of their populations as opposed to ours, they have better outcomes at a lower per person cost than we do in this country.
Well, what about that?
Yeah, those are a couple of points that you hear a lot, and there's some truth to them, but probably not as much as the caller might hope. So let's take them in order. Medicare does have low administrative costs. It has that for a couple of reasons. One is the conventional accounting doesn't include a lot of their costs. So if you look at how Medicare keeps its books, it doesn't count a lot of the costs of administering the program. For example, Congress spends a fair chunk of its time thinking about Medicare and passing bills with relation to Medicare, and the Department of Health and Human Services also spends a lot of time doing that. Most of those costs are not included because of the way CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, keeps its books on administrative costs. Medicare also doesn't incur any advertising costs because it has a monopoly position. Now, you know, you could lower anybody's administrative costs by giving them a monopoly position, but in general, we don't think that's a good idea. So, you know, what you're facing here is a trade-off between competition and monopoly. In most sectors of the economy, we have, I think, quite rightly concluded, competition gives us overall better outcomes, even though it has higher administrative costs. And the book has some discussion on both of those points. Second, on negotiating drug prices, the bill that got passed for prescription drug benefits, Medicare Part D, and there's a chapter on that that talks about some of the problems with that, basically said that Medicare or the federal government could not buy for the entire United States or directly negotiate drug prices, but it used a somewhat different approach, which was to allow Medicare to contract out for pharmacy benefit managers to fill this role for it. And the basic idea was that lots of pharmacy benefit managers competing with one another on both price and on coverage would give a better result. This is a sort of more competition-oriented model. And, you know, the proof of this, I think, is going to be in the pudding. The donut hole, the gap in coverage that people are often talking about, a lot of the private plans have succeeded in filling because they've aggressively negotiated drug prices. I think this is certainly going to be something that the Democrats are going to be very interested in Congress. it's going to turn out to be actually because of the way the Part D benefit is structured, it's going to be hard to solve this problem without tinkering or tampering with the larger structure of the benefit. And I think the other point to make is, you know, when you're basically buying lots and lots of pharmaceuticals, as would happen if the government were buying it for the entire Medicare beneficiary population, you have the price control problem. Okay, we don't use price controls. We use the market to set prices in most of the economy because we've concluded that it's very hard for government to gather the information and to set the price properly. And pharmaceuticals are a big problem in that regard because it's very expensive to manufacture the first pill and it's dirt cheap to manufacture the second pill. And so there's always the temptation to drive the price down to the price of the second pill rather than allowing manufacturers to recover their costs of testing the drugs and bringing it to market. The result is if you set the price too low, you end up chilling innovation. And that's part of why costs go up, but it's also why quality of care can go up over time as well. Finally, on health outcomes and international comparisons, this is also a point you hear a lot. It's an important point, but it flows very directly from the way in which you measure health outcomes. Okay, so it's important. The short version is it's important to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So if we, how to be concrete about this, homogeneous populations have different health outcomes than heterogeneous populations. Okay, we have a population that compared to the rest of the world is fatter, and some of us shoot one another with a higher degree of frequency than is the case elsewhere in the world. And both of those things end up hurting your health statistics. Another issue is sort of infant mortality. If we, you know, different countries use different criteria for deciding who's born alive and who isn't. And so that ends up affecting your statistics as well. So you can slice and dice the data in different ways. If you ask instead of, you know, life expectancy at birth, if you say who's got more years starting at 70, you can get very different outcomes. And I don't want to suggest that one or the other is the right way to do it. I just want to say you need to be careful about how you use the data. We could certainly spend less money and get better quality healthcare services, but it's not clear that the type of reforms people are talking about now are going to do that.
Well, I think that certainly, you know, we need to work on public health and getting people to live healthier lifestyles, and maybe that's one big difference between us and much of the rest of the world, but I still not sure I buy all of your arguments. And, you know, like I said, you can look at the data different ways. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your calling, and I want to encourage you to read the book so you can conclude you don't agree with me after reading it.
All right, let's go on. Someone here again in Champaign-Urbanison, line number 3. Hello.
Hola. Comment on the Oregon plan. Oregon said they provided more access or greater coverage, but then they literally drew a line beyond which they wouldn't go to pay for some complex problems. And also on what about HMOs? The news said an HMO sent for the first time patient overseas and saved 90% on an op.
Okay, well, the caller is referring to a plan that Oregon came up with for broadening Medicaid, the program not for the elderly, which is Medicare, but for the poor, which is Medicaid. And the way in which Medicaid is currently structured, it covers limited population of the poor, but it's supposed to provide reimbursement for whatever they need. And Oregon's response to that was, we'd like to cover more people but pay for fewer things. And once they got through some legal limitations, they tried to come up with a list of what they would pay for and draw a line based on how much money they had. And, you know, this is the centralized purchasing problem or opportunity, depending on your point of view. They said, here's how much we've got, and if you're above the line, we'll pay for you, and if they're below the line, we won't. That was controversial, to say the least, particularly when it looked like some of the things that were above the line belong below the line and vice versa. And that again, is the problem with empowering centralized purchasers to make decisions for an entire population. Everybody can disagree, particularly when it comes to the services that they favor, if they're providers of those services, or they expect someone they know to need. And the program was intensely controversial for that simple reason. I think that points to some of the difficulties with one-payer systems, is you're going to end up with somebody somewhere making decisions about what to pay for. The second point, that's you're just trading off imperfection. The alternative is people making their own decisions. But resources are limited. They're going to be limited whether it's individuals making their decisions or the centralized purchaser. The second point was, what about international trade in healthcare services? Well, I guess, the sort of short answer is if it's cheaper to provide it somewhere else, then you ought to expect people to start looking for somewhere else to have it done. And that's as true of steel manufacture and car manufacture as it is of healthcare services. Most people don't know, but if you go to hospitals late at night to get an X-ray, many of them send your X-rays to Australia or India to be read because the people there are awake and they're in the hospital working, and they can do it a lot cheaper than calling in someone from the local community. And, for the same reasons we think there are gains from trade in other areas, people in healthcare are coming to face up to that as well.
Champaign County's next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm from the same camp as the last caller, and I think that if you look at the statistics and the reality of healthcare in this country and this world, you can't say something blanket like you have said, that we have decided that the market makes the best decision on prices, because that's I think that's patently untrue. You can probably manipulate the figures however you would like. I was going to try and be civil, but you've said so many really outrageous things that as far as fraud in the Medicare system, I think the biggest thing that would have helped is if we had actually prosecuted, the U.S. government had actually prosecuted HCA, which was connected to Frist, Senator Frist, the majority leader, who when you were on the Hill, you probably had to deal with him about who you were going to have testify and who you were going to have talk. I mean, the corporate criminals that are running the big pharma and a lot of the programs are really what ought to, were the responsibility. Maybe we'll have some follow through on that. Maybe Frist will be prosecuted after the fact. But, he cut a deal to get HCA off the hook. And you're presuming that somehow we don't have rationing now in your tone. We have rationing now. Why don't we? I think the Social Security system myth is pervasive. If we have this one-time saving, save things by actually having a lot of preventative care, and then have a reasonable tax structure, we can have the best medical system in the world and actually provide more coverage than we're doing now. And we wouldn't be arguing about this rationing. We're rationing by dumping right down the street from you, where you are right now at Carl. They have a certain number of Medicare patients they treat, Medicaid patients they treat. So I think I'll have to stop because I'm getting too outraged here. Thank you.
Well, I certainly want to agree with the caller that we have rationing now. I thought that was a point that I'd made several times. The choice that you make is how do you ration, who rations, and what kind of safeguards do you build into the system. I think it's hard to view the way we do it now as being optimal, but there are better and worse ways of going from here. On fraud in the Medicare system, I just encourage the caller to read the book and look at the chapter on fraud. There's lots of evidence on fraud that I think, I won't say it's pervasive, but there is certainly a significant problem with differing kinds of fraud in the Medicare program.
Do you mention HCA and Frist in your text?
I don't believe I mentioned Frist. I do mention a number of the high-profile litigations, including HCA, and I think I would just encourage the caller to read the chapter rather than debate with him about individuals.
Well, I was pointing out that you were part of the operation on the Hill that sets the parameters of the debate, and if you have a guy like him who is with this firm, he's obviously protecting. I mean, one of the first things they did was cut the deal for HCA.
It's
a bunch of baloney. I hope you have a contrary view real soon, David. Thank you.
Well, look, first of all, if you look at fraud enforcement in the Medicare program, it's generally done, it's almost invariably done civilly rather than criminally. And the Medicare rules are complicated, and there are certainly, you know, people who are hardcore fraudsters. There's also lots of areas where there's retroactive interpretations of the rules that people end up reasonably disagreeing about what was meant, and they end up settling often for very large amounts of money because it's easier to do that than to be closed down. I actually have never met Senator Frist, and so I don't know where the caller gets off with that interpretation, but that's here nor there. I think finally my comment that we've decided the market makes the best decisions about pricing was in the context of talking about the larger economy. We do use regulation to deal with a variety of problems, but including force, fraud, duress, asymmetric information. But generally speaking, we think the market is a better way of collecting information and communicating information than centralized decision making. And that's why groceries look the way that they do, car markets look the way that they do, clothes markets look the way that they do, and even healthcare looks the way that it does.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Hyman. He's professor of medicine and law at the University of Illinois and is in his research, among other things, interested in the regulation of healthcare financing. And we're talking about Medicare. This is a subject we have discussed in the past. I'm sure, again, we will have other guests in the future. If you want to hear different points of view, we're certainly trying to put out a number of different points of view on the subject, as we have with Social Security and with pension issues, and we'll continue to try to do that. And Medicaid, that's another show entirely as well. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next is someone in Champaign. This is Lion 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Listen, earlier I heard some discussion regarding the marketplace and who is making the decisions regarding the purchasing of healthcare services and products, and you indicated that one reasonable model is that these decisions are driven by the actual patient, the consumer. I think that's rather disingenuous because in most instances, a patient is required, if he's going to have any sense at all, to follow his physician's advice. And indeed, an individual can refuse to follow his physician's advice, act against medical advice, but particularly in the arena of litigation, whether it be workers' compensation, personal injury, medical malpractice, one of the things that will invariably come up from the defense's perspective is that this patient's not following medical advice. So my question is, you know, what exactly do you mean when you're talking about patients driving the decisions about purchasing medical services and care and products? Because it seems to me that the patient, particularly in emergent situations, has very little input into the decision-making regarding purchasing those services. I'll get off and listen to you from there. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is, I think, an important question. People make healthcare decisions either through proxies or with the assistance of agents would be the way that economists and lawyers would talk about it. So, you know, you can't walk into a hospital and say, I'd like an MRI, and then come back the next day and ask for a CT scan. So certainly people go to their physicians for advice on what's wrong with them and recommendations as to how they should be treated, and they decide whether to accept those recommendations and receive services either by that provider or by somebody else, or they go somewhere else and try and get a different set of recommendations, or they just decide not to do anything at all. So you're certainly right that healthcare providers have a very profound impact on the services that are recommended to patients. But they can't force them to receive those services, right? Individuals decide whether or not to consent to treatment, and their decisions are going to be influenced by their out-of-pocket costs associated with those decisions. So the reason why we have deductibles and co-payments is precisely because we think that individual patients have some control over their decisions, even though they use agents to make decisions. And, you know, nobody's suggesting that individual patients are perfectly informed about healthcare services. That's precisely why we have physicians and other healthcare providers. And physicians, you know, make lots of decisions that affect the scope of what services are provided. The typical numbers are doctors get paid about 20% of the healthcare dollar, but they control directly or indirectly about 60 to 80% of it, depending upon which numbers you're looking at. But that doesn't affect the simple fact that, you know, people who are facing copayments and deductibles decide it's worth it to me to buy this pill or to receive this service, or it's not worth it to me to receive it. And my only point was you can, you know, by using more deductibles and copayments or less deductibles and copayments and instead empowering a centralized decision maker or a person who writes the insurance policy, they have a profound impact on what services are received and what costs are incurred.
We'll try to do at least one more caller. Atwood, line four.
Yeah, I got a comment. I think Social Security and Medicare have a surplus, but Congress keeps taking all of the surplus away and putting it in a general fund. And then they say, well, they're in trouble. And if they'd stop stealing from it, we wouldn't have a problem.
That's a common observation, but it's in important respects and a misperception. So let me be clear what I mean by that. In any given year, currently, both Medicare and Social Security run a surplus. That is to say, they collect more than they pay out. And what they do with that money is they send it over to the Treasury. Actually, it's at the Treasury. And they get a piece of paper that says, when we need the money back, we will you'll pay us the money back. And the federal government uses those surpluses in Social Security and Medicare to pay off its regular bills. And that has consequences for the larger budget picture. But money is money in important respects. Okay. Now, when we're talking about the present value of the amounts that the Medicare program has promised to pay versus what it's going to receive, we're including all those surpluses as assets. And similarly, when we say, when is the trust fund, quote, bankrupt? Again, I don't much like that language, but people use it. We're also treating those as real assets. Now, strictly speaking, they're just pieces of paper, meaning that future taxpayers are going to have to come up with that money. Okay? But the important point is that we promise more than we expect that we're going to end up having. And just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the problem in, you know, slightly easier to grasp numbers, if you just look at the hospitalization benefit, Part A, and you just look over the next 75 years, the deficit in that program is about $11 trillion. Now, it's hard to make sense of that number, so let me give you a concrete way of thinking about it. We either increase Medicare's taxes today by 121%, or we cut Medicare benefits today by 56%. Okay? And if we wait, we have to do more to fix that problem. And that's just a small part of the program for just the next 75 years. This is not a program that's going to be there in the long run if we keep doing what we're doing.
We have a couple of minutes left. What I want to do here, just to wrap up, as we said at the beginning, I think that there are a lot of people who would agree that the program as it is not sustainable, that we can't keep going the way we're going. Where you get the disagreement is when you ask people, all right, what should we do about it? So let me ask you the what should we do about it question. For you, what would be your solution to the problem?
Well, if it's all right, David, let me just start by giving a broader set of options in the sure. few minutes that we have, so people can have a sense.
We only got about two minutes.
I don't want to suggest that there's only one right answer to this problem. Good. I think reasonable people can disagree. I think a lot depends on your prior assumptions about what you think the program ought to be doing. All right. So one solution to the program, and let me start at the opposite end of the distribution from I think where I am, is to just nationalize healthcare financing generally, either federal or state level approaches to the program. California was thinking about doing this until the governor vetoed it. Medicare for all or a single payer is one way to sort of conceptualize that. Okay, that's one approach. And then sort of backing off down the spectrum, you can think about maintaining the current program, but aggressive price controls on the amounts that we pay, aggressive volume controls on how many services we're willing to pay for. then you can start to think about more significant changes in the program. Means testing is a way of saying, look, we ought to be transferring resources to people who need them and not to people who are better off than those paying into the system. So why should a single mom with no health insurance be paying wage taxes into Medicare to provide benefits to wealthy retirees in Florida? And then, at the far end of the distribution would be a defined contribution approach or a Medicare voucher where we give beneficiaries a fixed dollar amount and tell them they can go buy health insurance in the market. And I think where you locate, and there are obviously all sorts of other possibilities and lots of variations, but where you locate yourself along that spectrum is going to reflect your own political views, how well you think the general economy is doing, how much you think government should be involved in health care, and so on.
Okay. Well, at that, I think we're probably going to stop, again, with the promise that this is not the last show on the subject. We will seek out some other guests and other viewpoints. But if you're interested in further exploring this one that has been offered by a guest, David Hyman, you can look at his book, Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. It's published by the Cato Institute. David Hyman is professor of law and medicine here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being here.